Iraq has not invaded anywhere. It hasn't threatened us. As far as we know, it is not linked to international terrorism. There is no clear evidence of that.
We are, in fact, ladies and gentlemen, in a worldwide war right now. We must become a country that first and foremost tries to establish peace.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, November 13th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Facing a tight deadline and the threat of war, Iraq has accepted a tough new UN resolution that will return weapons inspectors to the country after nearly 4 years. Iraq's UN ambassador, Dr. Mohammed Al-Duri, says the resolution was accepted with no conditions and no reservations.
Iraq will deal with the Security Council Resolution 1441 despite its bad contents. We are prepared to receive the inspectors within the assigned timetable. We are eager to see them perform their duties in accordance with international law as soon as possible.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan will meet with President Bush in the White House. Susan Wright is the author of Biological Warfare and Disarmament, New Problems, New Perspectives. She's also a research scientist at the University of Michigan in the Institute for Research on Women and Gender. After word of Iraq's acceptance, we asked Wright if she's surprised Saddam Hussein accepted the resolution without conditions.
Possibly, yes, because the resolution 1441 dramatically expands the original requirements of the Gulf War ceasefire resolution. I see two problems, generally. The first problem is that the requirements for reporting are so much broader than the original resolution at 687, which referred only to weapons purposes. These requirements refer to peaceful purposes as well, any purposes. So the expansion is really very great. And second, that there's, you know, what is called the dual purpose problem, and that is that anything in the biological area and a good deal of the technology used in the chemical area too can be used both for peaceful purposes and for weapons, so that the onus on Iraq is enormous to report all of this. You know, I wonder if any industrialized state could do such reporting in 30 days.
Mm-hmm. So Iraq is going to be required to report all of the biological and chemical agents that they have that could be used for either peaceful or warlike purposes. Is that what you're saying?
I think so, because the phrase is including any facilities, and programs which Iraq claims are for purposes not related to weapons production or material. That is very broad indeed.
So
it covers breweries, yogurt making factories. It's just huge and mind boggling. If that's the intention, I don't know whether there's any interpretive language that says what the council really means. But this would be very, very difficult for a state to comply with. And there's a kind of irony here, because in connection with the proposed inspection regime for the Biological Weapons Convention, the United States has argued that it would be impossible to address all conceivable biological facilities for inspection purposes. And yet here we are expecting Iraq to do precisely, to provide us with the material to do precisely that, it seems.
I also saw reports today that say that President Saddam Hussein has ordered 1.25 million doses of atropine, which is the antidote for nerve gas.
Yes.
I would think that in and of itself might be, unless that's reported, and would that be considered peaceful, or or warlike purposes. How would something like that factor into the equation, and what does that really say to us, that he's ordering these nerve gas anecdotes?
Yes, it is certainly interesting. Is there a war of nerves going on here? Of course, Iraq is very afraid that this resolution will be used as a pretext for going to war. And as you know, the CIA has said that the most likely use of chemical weapons by Iraq, assuming it still has some, would be in the event that we go to war, and then he perceives that he has no other possibility of combat, of retaliation.
So I guess it sort of begs the question, is he planning to use it, or is he suspecting that the U.S. might use it against him? And could this anecdote also be used as a weapon?
Well, it could be seen, it can be seen as a threat that will make U.S. combat troops wear protective clothing, which, as you know, is cumbersome, hot, and so on. Very difficult to fight in. So it may be that, you know, it's a bluff.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, since the other side will not know whether it's a bluff or not, it's a war of nerves, I think.
Mm.
You know, we're playing the same game in many ways in drafting a resolution that is so broad that it's possible that any minor error could be used as an excuse to launch a war. And that's probably what the Iraqis are afraid of. So on both sides, it's a war of nerves, I think.
Secretary of State Colin Powell said that the U.S. would not have to resort to unleashing a chemical weapon like that on the world, that they have other ways of dealing with Saddam Hussein. For example, worst case scenario, one side released this nerve gas. What kind of ramifications would that have for not only the people in the immediate area, but those in surrounding neighboring countries as well?
Well, I think that's a very good question. Chemical weapons are, the reason they're called weapons of mass destruction is that they're indiscriminate. If this were an urban warfare situation, innocent civilians would definitely be harmed. Now, I would like to point out one thing, that the United States is a party to the Chemical Weapons Convention and the Biological Weapons Convention. Iraq is only a party to the Biological Treaty. So under the Chemical Weapons Convention, which the U.S. is bound by, the U.S. would not use chemical weapons. But of course, because of the very relaxed conditions that the Bush administration has placed on nuclear weapons, it could resort to nuclear in principle anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a step that will fill almost every country in the world with horror. And I think there will be a lot of pressure on the Bush administration not to do that.
And
but as I say, I think we're thinking hypothetically here, and I want to stress that it could be that Saddam is bluffing.
Well, the reports indicate that he actually made the purchase from Turkey. So.
Yes, of course. Yeah, but I'm arguing, if I can interrupt, that's part of the bluff, that he takes this ambiguous move, and the United States does not know why.
Mm-hmm.
And then that forces the other side to use protective gear just in case.
Susan Wright is the author of Biological Warfare and Disarmament, New Problems, New Perspectives. She's also a research scientist at the University of Michigan in the Institute for Research on Women and Gender. If the U.S. wages war against Iraq, the human toll would be catastrophic. A report released today by Medac predicts casualties could rise as high as 250,000 in the first 3 months. Those estimates are drawn from studies of the Persian Gulf War and U.S. actions in Somalia and Panama. It also takes into account likely Iraq invasion scenarios. Pentagon experts discuss the possibility of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein placing military targets within civilian sites, such as hospitals and schools. Dr. Bob Gould is chair of the Peace Caucus of the American Public Health Association and president-elect of Physicians for Social Responsibility.
Obviously, the direct effect of warfare in terms of the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians who were innocent in the, of what whatever brutality or whatever problems of the Saddam Hussein regime might represent, and as well the deaths of soldiers that would be sent to carry out the war. But if you think about what the likely destruction and problems resulting from that of any war in the area are likely to be immense and would dwarf the well-documented problems for the Iraqi people that have been shown by the sanctions regime up until this point.
What about any kind of unexpected or unpredicted so-called perhaps collateral damage to the public health system here in the U.S. as well?
Well, the damage that can occur here could be, a variety of possible problems. Certainly, in terms of the potential for response or retaliation from a desperately cornered Iraqi regime, even the CIA was warning in a report a number of weeks ago that the Iraqi regime, Saddam, would be more likely to use his putative weapons of mass destruction if he was literally in a use-em-or-lose-em type of situation, if he's cornered. And they warned about going to war that he might, if he does indeed have chemical and biological agents, fire them off. So that would be the sort of direct results of that.
Mm-hmm.
But in more profound effects in terms of going to war, Secretary of Treasury Paul O'Neill, about a month and a half ago, very blithely referred to the estimated $200 billion that it would cost to wage war in Iraq. And expenditures of that sort would not be available for the public health and other health programs for the people mm-hmm. of the United States.
Can you think of some programs that might really stand to lose the most from something like that, that might be the first in the first line of fire, so to speak?
Well, we've already seen that there are significant programs throughout the public health apparatus that are already being cut from diversion to preparedness programs such as bioterrorism. But we're talking about basic programs that protect the environmental health of Americans. We're talking about resources that are available for protecting people against industrial pollution, from water pollution. I mean, there are a whole host of programs that go starving right now in this country. We're talking about, we are, of course, dealing with a situation where about 44 million American people are without health insurance. And particularly with the Republican administration poised already to make devastating budget cuts on basic programs that are available to Americans in this regard, we can only wonder what even more constraints would bring.
Dr. Gold, you have introduced two resolutions, I believe, to the American Public Health Association. Tell us about the one where you're calling for the United States to support a strengthened biological weapons convention.
This resolution, again, really deals, we think, more fundamentally with the threats posed by biological weapons, whether used by state actors or terrorists. And in this case, we want to see a strengthened biological weapons convention because the Biological Weapons Convention, which the United States is a signatory to, has a number of loopholes in the sense that,
for example,
well, countries such as the United States that are allowed under the treaty to conduct research with deadly biological agents in order to develop vaccines and countermeasures. And an example of this is the United States, a week before 9/11, in an article published in the New York Times by Judith Miller and William Broad, the authors of Germs, it was revealed that the United States, for example, was working, was developing plans to develop genetically modified anthrax. Now, the work with genetic modification of organisms is something that we've been, leveling against ex-Russian scientists and also regimes such as Iraq. And clearly, one of the main impetuses for going to war at this point is supposedly to take out this type of capacity. However, the United States claims that its work with such organisms is purely for defensive reasons, to test our vaccines. And if narrowly interpreted, this would fall within the confines of the present regime.
So you don't want the U.S. to be able to work with these these biological...
Well, it's a problem not only for the United States working on these organisms, but any country around the world. And these loopholes are well known, and for this reason, there's been a global effort over the past 6 years to develop new protocols which would tighten inspection and verification mechanisms. So in other words, at a time when we're talking about inspecting the Iraq facilities and their capacity to make nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, the effort to tighten the loopholes would be to have anything up to, short-term, quickly announced inspections to see what the capabilities of various research projects are to develop weapons. These were mightily opposed by the pharmaceutical and biotech companies of the United States, saying that such types of a tightened and strengthened inspection regime would prejudice their proprietary rights.
So we want to have weapons inspections in Iraq, but not here in the U.S.
No, the United States is vigorously opposed having us undergo these types of, vigorously enforced weapons inspections here, or potential weapons inspections. And, of course, having such a vigilant inspection regime could also expose projects that the United States has been keeping under wraps. At the same time that it was exposed that the United States had these plans to develop genetically modified anthrax, it was also revealed that we had developed a prototype germ bomb factory in the Nevada test site. So it actually to explore weapons that could disperse biological agents.
Dr. Bob Gould is chair of the Peace Caucus of the American Public Health Association and president-elect of Physicians for Social Responsibility and a pathologist at Kaiser Hospital in San Jose. Talk in the United Nations over the past several weeks has revolved around averting war with Iraq, but according to WPFW commentator Terry Kester, that moment has long since passed.
You know, sometimes you just got to get off the ranch to get a little perspective, ladies and gentlemen, and I had the privilege of being abroad and in Europe, as a matter of fact, in Italy and in Rome. And the feeling between the United States and Europe is night and day. The point I'm trying to make, ladies and gentlemen, is that we are at war now. And we have been mistaken in our approach in trying to prevent this war from escalating. We haven't realized that we are already at a full-fledged war level, and we have been since 9/11. Maybe necessarily so. I'm not going to argue that. Maybe because of the bombing of the attacks on U.S. embassies, the attack on USS Cole, certainly the attack of 9/11, maybe necessarily, but the point is we are at war now, whether we realize it or not. We are at full war level in Afghanistan. We are at war in Pakistan. We are at war in Israel. We are at war in Yemen. We are at war in Iraq. Yes, we are. It's not a question of when we're going to invade. It's just whether we're going to start another front. That's all. We are at war in Iraq. We are at war in the Republic of Georgia. If we count the bases from where we launch and plan attacks, as well as the countries where we're actually involved shooting and killing people, then the list expands even further. We are at war in Djibouti. We are at war in Kuwait. We are at war in Qatar. We are at war in Saudi Arabia. We are at war in Turkey. If we count the countries where we have CIA and other intelligence agencies operatives, this list is practically endless. We are, in fact, ladies and gentlemen, in a worldwide war right now. Now, basically, those of us who have been trying to prevent war have missed the boat. We didn't really listen to President Bush. He told us from the very beginning that we are at war, and he meant it as a declaration of war. Our country, this administration, our military, our economy, our society is fully at war. And all you need to do to discover this, ladies and gentlemen, is do as I did. Go abroad and feel the difference. Italy is not at war. Europe is not at war. England is getting closer to being at war. You come back into this country, you feel the paranoia, you feel the fear, you feel the militarism, you feel the intimidation. Then you just look at the global picture where we're involved militarily, and ladies and gentlemen, we are at war. So therefore, the issue is not preventing the war. That's already happened. The issue is, how do we end the war? And rather, really, the most important thing, ladies and gentlemen, is how do we build the peace? And when do we start building the peace? And this is crucial, because this war is a war without end. This is a war that cannot end unless establishing peace is our first goal. Look at any terrorist-led, terrorist-inspired war of the past or current. Look at Ireland and Great Britain, the Troubles, as they euphemistically call them. It's been going on for over 1,000 years. Look at the decades of back-and-forth terrorism and all-out war in the Middle East. This kind of war that we are involved in, that we may be as much a terrorist in response to the terrorism as the terrorists are, this kind of war is endless. And we've got to change the debate now. We must become a country that first and foremost tries to establish peace.
WPFW commentator Terry Kester. Earlier this week, we heard from Bob Fritakis, a political science professor at Ohio State University and an investigative journalist who exposed in Columbus Live newspaper the U.S.'s responsibility in the military anthrax development as a biological weapon. Today, Fritakis is no longer with the newspaper. He was fired just as he exposed the Bush family's ties to al-Qaeda. Reem Kathuda investigated what led to his dismissal from the newspaper, where he has been a columnist for 5 years and received 3 journalists awards.
The last article I did pointed out a Wall Street Journal in a Senate intelligence report noting that Harkin Oil, the president's oil company, George W. Bush, when he sold it, is that the people that bought it were from BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, or the Bank of Crooks and Criminal International. If you recall, the largest bank fraud in world history, with $15 to $20 billion missing. But they are also the same people that funded a group called al-Qaeda in the late 80s. And al-Qaeda had the same money source, BCCI, which we know from Senate documents, Senator Kerry's committee got its money from running opiates out of the Golden Crescent in the area of Afghanistan. And it should be no surprise, since al-Qaeda was the U.S. network, which was put together in part to wage a jihad against the Soviet Union. Al-Qaeda and the United States were working hand-in-hand through the Saudis and Pakistan through their ISI, their intelligence service. Same way the Taliban was secretly backed by the U.S. I mean, it was only U.S. allies, United Arab Emirates, Pakistan and Saudi Arabia that recognized the Taliban, which was manufactured in the madrasas in Pakistan, and went in and took over the country. And when they were brought here in 1997, who brought them around on a PR tour of the U.S.? Lily Helms, the niece of Richard Helms, the recently deceased CIA director. So if you look at it, it's blowback, as the CIA says. The al-Qaeda, it's our network that turned on us over issues like us having a base in Saudi Arabia. These are people we put together, we trained, made in the USA. That's why they're so good. The net effect of me writing this stuff, of course, finest tradition of American journalism, is I lost my job, as well as Harvey Wasserman, and another individual who questioned the Bush agenda. But, you know, that's just the way I think corporate for-profit media operates in the U.S.
What was the excuse they gave you?
People wanted more bar-hopping information. There was a column by the Meltdown ladies, and that they covered bars, and if they talked to you at the bar, they would put your name in bold print. So the public was clamoring for columns on bar-hopping and didn't want to read the kind of stuff that I wrote, but preferred to know which bar they could get drunk at.
And this came at the tail of you getting a couple of awards, which one would think would raise the readership of the newspaper.
Ironically, they called me the day before I picked up 2 awards from the Ohio Society of Professional Journalism, one for best criminal justice reporting in the state, first place, and second place for best coverage of government. And in fact, the editorial justifying the firing of Harvey Wasserman, who's internationally famous as an expert on nuclear energy, was that journalists weren't our peers, is that it was the people at bars we really needed to bond with. And while those awards are nice, nobody really wants to read that kind of stuff in the United States. So I guess it's the great ironies in history. Well, I thought I might be done in by the CIA or something glamorous. I was done in by a woman named Bella, who writes a bar hopping column.
Is this the crescendo meltdown of journalism in this country at the eve of a potential going to war?
The last time in here in central Ohio, there was only two people in the mainstream media that didn't wear yellow ribbons and go along with the war. One was the insight editor of the Columbus Dispatch, Marty Yant, who was fired after writing a group of columns that all later turned out to be true and are in a book called Desert Mirage, questioning the lies of the Bush administration. He was forced out of his job, forced to resign. And a man named Jim Blykamp, who was a radio talk show host, who asked Representative Kasich why he changed his mind, why originally he wanted sanctions to go on for a year and then agreed to vote to attack after 5 months. When he refused to apologize for daring to ask that question, he had to spend some time selling dishwashers and appliances at Sun TV. Talk magazine called him the first casualty of war. So what I think is anytime you're gearing up for a war, and our media in part, the Time, Warner, Turner's, AOL, EMI, and or, you know, General Electric, which owns NBC, anytime your largest military contractor in the world owns one of your major stations, is that of course you're going to try to get rid of all alternative voices. But fortunately, with the internet and grassroots ways of communication, the word's going to get out. The word's going to get out through radio stations like this, through other publications. I publish the Free Press, through internet pages like freepress.org, and just hundreds of thousands of Americans that want to know the truth and that are unafraid. And that's the finest tradition of American dissent.
Is this what keeps your hope up? I walked in a room where you had more than 25 organizers from all over Ohio. What are some of the things you told them as far as the media and its role and how to harness it to stop this war?
If we go out and do our jobs in the street, if we do our research, we can force corporate media to be the journalists they should be and appeal to reason, which had a 750,000 circulation in 1912. The underground presses of the 1970s is that the United States has a long tradition, whether it's the Committee of Correspondence during the Revolutionary War, has this long, long tradition of getting the truth out. We have the internet, we have internet radio, we have newsletters. We can put out zines, we can put out broadsides, and we can take our voice to the street, as was done today in a very, very successful anti-war rally in Columbus, Ohio. I believe that there's something at stake here, and that the American people know it. That's whether or not there'll be the free flow of information in American society. And I think ultimately the people will triumph, and that their voices will be heard. And they're being heard now on the internet and in other forms through public access, through community radio. And I think we need to have a revolution and bring back some small powered radios and hear as many diverse voices as we can, because they can't cover up these stories. The truth is out there. And in the end, the truth will come out and it will set us free, and it will liberate us from now what we have is this smiley military-industrial complex that is obsessed with war to cover up corporate crimes. So I think in the long run, democracy will work, and the press will be free.
And this is Bob Fitrakis, editor of Free Press.
The articles of Bob Fitrakis can be found online at freepress.com and columbuslive.com.